How about threats or pressure from other sources? Was the Ku Klux Klan or other white racist groups active in Howard and Montgomery counties during this period?
Well, during my tenure in Howard County as president, before my tenure, we did have the so-called John Birch Society blossoming up. We also had a strong pro-Wallace faction there. They didn't parade as Ku Klux Klaners, so I don't know what they really call themselves. There was no encounter, to my knowledge, with NAACP officers or its activities. Of course, whenever we appeared at the school board and public hearings, there were these factions contending on the opposite side of the fence. They were diametrically opposed to desegregation, and we were strongly in favor of doing it now, not postponing it or not drawing it out 5, 10, 15 years. Proposal and counterproposal would be during that period of the early civil rights days. There was always that thought expressed that we can't do it now, it must be gradualism, or it must be on a quote or number game or procedure. The NAACP at the Howard County level and also at the state level took the position that it was a proposition to be dealt with emphatically now. Not next year, year after next, year after next. First proposal that evolved from Howard County was somewhat on a 12-year plan, step by step. Well, we didn't abide that. It was finally accepted. It would be through the sixth grade and later on, step by step, year by year like that. Finally, it did end up with a fell swoop when they closed Harriet Tubman High School, which was the only high school open as an all-Negro, all-Black school, and in 1963, began that fall with just one high school program for all. Busing was an issue in those days. There were groups that wanted them to provide a bus for the whites and bus for the blacks. We are diametrically opposed to that segregation on school buses as a public means of conveying students to and from school. I would still be opposed today. They don't segregate when they ride public buses. We have fought that barrier, Jim Crow, ism on trains, planes, and buses. We weren't interested in having it revisit in the school system. We waged a pretty strong issue or attacks against that form of procedure. The problem also showed itself here in Montgomery County. There instances of county when it didn't want students from school where I was principal, all black, to transfer into Poolsville, Sherwood, you name a few other places. But if those barriers were handled differently in this county, we had a desegregation committee appointed by the board and chaired by person for whom I had great respect and worked rather closely with me in the early days of desegregation, this kind of the person, Fred Dawn, who was principal of Perry High School and was also involved in that suit against the Sentinel. He's the principal there. So that's an indication of how differences occurred, but the early pattern showed itself almost county by county and state by state. In the desegregation process, the first step was to either close the all-Negro school, use the building as a public office building on the Board of Education or something, or decapitate school. If it were a high school, we'd make it a junior high school. If it were a junior high school, you'd make it an elementary school or something of that sort. And we have seen that method sort of run its course, I think. Now, that's about as much as far as anybody ever sent me any hostile letters or do anything like that. I was never the recipient of. Of course, I wasn't the type that went out and hung sign on your back and stood on every street corner filled with rhetoric. I didn't prefer to work that way and still don't. I did prefer to work with groups. I did prefer to gather my data carefully and screen it and use it in any form, written form, oral form, and I didn't do a great deal of just personal dialogue. I never have, probably never will. I always felt when you educate people's minds, somehow or another, their behaviors are altered. I still feel that way.
During this period, the 1950s, did you have any consciousness or awareness of McKeldin's attitude or McKeldin's role as governor?
Oh, yes. So we were always impressed with him. He received any delegation well that went there. He attempted to follow various kinds of suggestions, and as far as I could see, he did a pretty good job of keeping his formal commitments, whatever he enunciated. As far as I know, I wasn't on the political circles, political circuit, still not, but from my general observation, he was pretty pronounced in his behavior. And he did break barriers in appointing blacks to certain administrative posts that never had held before in the history of Maryland. But the state as a whole, from McKeldin regime on down, governors had the way of shying away from the basic concerns of the black movement and civil rights. Governor after governor, and not let themselves become too involved in those areas, other than to provide some good service. I would say McKeldin was a forerunner of new thought in this area of race relations. From the time I came to the state, from the time that he ended his administration, I certainly think he did a good job of breaking or making the trail for changes. Of course, we know we could go back to when they got rid of the old Jim Crow law here in the state, came right on up to appointments of black to administrative boards in the state, judgeships and so forth. And yet, governors since McKeldin have had an opportunity to even do more of that. Governor Mandel has done a good bit along that line. He's been accused of doing for political patronage, and who doesn't? All that part of the political game. Governor Tarles did some, but he didn't do as much as I never thought he did what he was certainly capable of doing during his administration.
Do you think McKeldin was sincere on civil rights?
I felt that he was very sincere. I always thought that, and still do.
You didn't think he did it for political patronage?
Well, some of that is involved in anything they do, yes. He would have been no exception on that, but I don't think that was his sole reason. I think he had a firm conviction, and I think he expressed it, and not only in his words, but he did it with many of his acts. Whether he could have done more or not, I'll never know. I never had a chance to ever sit down and interview the man, talk with him, get that close to his administration. But I voted for him every occasion he ran for public office, and would do it again.
How do you feel about his preaching in black churches?
I felt that was a sincere part of him. I just never found anything sincere. I listened to him. He was a great orator, and he had a higher political ambition, so I don't think that he fully realized. But I think he was sincere when he preached in black churches and preached and attended the meetings of black audiences and spoke, such as the Elks and the Masons and others. He was very active also in those of fraternal and circles, from my knowledge. For one who a native son of Baltimore himself, he was a different individual to what one normally got from, shall we say, the ruling class of Baltimore. I had seen the superintendent of schools there and others. They were pretty retrenched in that feeling, and it came out in the public gathering. I think McClellan did a lot to keep down friction in the early days in Baltimore City by his attitude, by the reputation that he had obtained throughout the state and nationwide at that particular time.
Could you give us any insights into the relationship between Governor McClellan and Mrs. Jackson?
Well, it was very close. Mrs. Jackson had great admiration for Governor McClellan, and I always saw it as being mutual. I think Governor McClellan really had true respect for Mrs. Jackson and for the work that she was dutifully engaged in civil rights. But with Mrs. Jackson, there wasn't but one right way. That was, from my experience with her, that was to show the utmost respect for all people. She loved her family, and I believe she really had a genuine love for humanity, period. And my years of close working relationship with her, I never heard her speak disdainfully of any person. And that didn't mean she wouldn't take issue with you. She used to stress very much that not the personality that mattered, but it was the principle. She kept that before us as president. Do not let yourself stray from the principles of this movement. It's not just for mere socialization that we are asking for equal opportunity. Not just because the black man wants to fraternize with the white woman, or the white man wants to fraternize with the black woman. It is that the rights of an individual to do what is legally permissible. If there's a bad law, then you give obedience to the law. But in the meantime, stop marshaling your forces to try to change it. So I don't think she was very much on the passive resistance theory. I never heard her in my years of working with Ms. Jackson ever venture along that line. She used to say that we had a responsibility to respect the law, and we had a greater responsibility if it was a bad law to work to change it. And that's what we went after, try to change every bad law we could find. So that was the goal. We couldn't change people's hearts, but we certainly had every right and responsibility to seek to make adequate changes in the law. So in a sum total, that's about the best I can say as far as my memory lets me recall of it.
Do you think Governor McClellan could accept black people as equals? Do you think any of his concern was sort of a paternalistic concern?
Well, I would have to say, not having worked very closely with him, I would have to say I saw some aspects of the paternalism in it. But I think when he made overtures to black, that he was sincere in that point. I didn't find that degree of insincerity. And I never heard anyone that knew him well ever express that feeling. They seemed to have thought that they were accepted for their merits. All that I've ever heard come in about him or worked closely with him. I never had that pleasure. So I was always on the periphery of activity. I never had that firsthand, close feeling or observation. So beyond anything I'd say would be hearsay.
How about your relationship with Mrs. Jackson's daughter, Juanita Jackson Mitchell?
Well,
Could you discuss that? Been very close
over the years. Well, I always, I don't know, I guess I just thought of Mrs. Mitchell felt like I think of a sister. I always found her very sincere. I always found her very persuasive and very diligent in her efforts to reach a goal. Very good at setting goals and working towards the attainment of those goals. Yet at that particular time, she had her own family to rear, plus her career, and her time was not as free, I found, as it was with her mother. She just couldn't do all those other things. Her mother's sole preoccupation was NAACP, from the time I knew her, from the time she gathered in the morning to the time you left her. That's her sole preoccupation. She was just in it and totally wrapped up in it, whether she did a national board meeting, whether she did home talking. So it was a case of priorities. Mrs. Mitchell, excellent state president, but she wasn't as free to move about due to her family ties and other responsibilities as a mother was. But she used her, not only did she use her interest, time, and money, she used her legal talent time after time in behalf of indigents and others throughout the state, deprived situations. And she's a very competent person, highly competent.
Do you see the Jackson Mitchell family as a vital force in the civil rights movement?
Oh, I think it's a very magnificent example of a family, total involvement, by family. I only wish that I could have gotten that out of my own. But my own has, at this point in time, has not become so involved. My children's interests seem to be widespread, quite scattered. So they haven't really taken on like the Mitchell Jackson family. It's really been interesting how the total family that reside in Baltimore City particularly has been duly involved in the civil rights movement. I don't know about those who are outside the city. I'm going to speak of those that I know. And the groundswell of support generally you would have to attribute to the willingness of members of that family to get out, scour through the community, and not only to be able to just talk things, but be able to become deeply involved in the implementation of plans, and also to sit down and develop strategies for dealing with would-be problems. And that's an amazing characteristic, that family loyalty, as well as that initiative to become totally involved in it. And I admire all her sons that I know, particularly Clarence the third and Michael. They've been the two that with whom I have identified most actively with over the years. Both of them have been very energetic and enterprising young men.
During the 50s and even into the 60s, what was the relationship between, for example, the Baltimore NAACP and the local county NAACPs?
Well, since Mrs. Jackson was president of the Baltimore branch, as well as the state branch, there was a very close involvement, very close. Most of the statewide activities at that particular time were held in Baltimore City, that being the only largest city and the great center of attraction. But since that time, there have been certain geographical shifts, and we find now that many of these counties can offer better facilities and accommodations for state meeting hall than you can get in Baltimore City, more accessible. So you found in recent years, the last 10 years particularly, activities have been directed more towards the county rather than the city. Plus the fact for a period of time that we didn't have a state office in the city, didn't have a state office anywhere, so it was a case of going to the most convenient place in one of the counties to have state meetings. And that's still the situation now. State meetings are generally held down there at in a church in Annapolis. Is this So we still don't have as much involvement from Baltimore City. It generally boils down now to a representative at state meeting. But years ago, when you went to Baltimore City, you had large numbers from the county and also a sizable representation from Baltimore City branch. Unfortunately, that representation from the city branch now has become minimal.
During the time when Mrs. Jackson was president of the state branch also, was she a dominant figure? Did she allow other opinion to seep in?
Well, without a doubt, Mrs. Jackson was not only dominant, nearing, she was overwhelming. So, not only at the county or state level, she also that same personnel on the national board. She didn't do it just for a personal aggrandizement of power. That wasn't her concept at all. It was just her personality, period. She believed strongly in something. She pushed it no matter where she was, in the halls of Congress or sitting in her living room. Same zeal and enthusiasm. I've been with her enough to see it. She'd be sitting in a person-to-person conference with you. The same zeal and enthusiasm expressed there would be expressed when she was standing before the national board, which at that time I think was only 40-some members, and that was increased to later on to 64 members. And whenever she made her foray or her spiel at the national board, it was done with a flair, and she was very dramatic and very forceful. It wasn't done half-heartedly, or maybe so, and maybe this. It wasn't but one point of view, Mrs. Jackson's point of view, that was important when she projected.
Did this ever produce conflict, either in Baltimore or with the local county branches?
Well, I never saw any vowed conflict that ended in factional fights during my day. Yes, there were differences of opinion. People expressed our opinion differently. And I always expressed the opinion that I felt was imminent from my point of view. You know, different orientations. Now, there may have been some who never did, had resentment. I don't know. I never ran into any of that group. We had some younger one during that period, the so-called Young Turks in Maryland, just like we had them at the national level, who felt that everybody over 30 should get out and move. And that feeling was prevalent during her period of time. And I rather suspect some of it is still prevalent. And I guess that will always be that youth versus adult conflict in our society. But now whether it comes out of open warfare is one thing, or whether it comes out as different approaches towards the same goal, which is another point to be taken into consideration. Because you choose to go east and I choose to go west, but if our mission is the same and we are goal-oriented, it really doesn't matter from my point of view which approach you pursue. But now, if our goals are vitally different, then I feel that we ought to sit down and honestly seek ways of reconciling the differences. Differences are important. And I've never been the type of person wanting to do away with differences. I like to weigh differences and try to see some kind of a consensus. I guess I've administrated schools that way, and I'm rather suspect that's my basic characteristic. I don't mind getting the differences on the table. I cannot deal well with hidden agenda. So I don't care what your point of view is, you present it and I present mine, then let's see what kind of a happy medium we can strike. If we can't, I go away knowing there are your basic objections. You go away assuming that you know mine. And we can still part as friends. I may never buy your point of view, and you may never buy mine, but at least I know now where we differ and why we differ and how we can still maybe work together on other issues. And that is always, I guess, and always will be my approach to dealing with social situations. That element of conflict is always inevitable, and I see it that way. And I wouldn't want to be in a situation where everybody's always agreeing, and it becomes very static and generally results with very little productivity. But take differences to heighten progress in a group. So I don't want any group where everybody thinks alike, prone to look alike, act alike, and you generally end up with not much anything being done. There got to be some differences of opinion. There got to be some different approaches. Then you sit down and plan the kind of strategy that will bring about varying degrees of cooperation as one strives for goal. If you don't do that, then you're not working effectively in an organization. Even in your own home.
Could you discuss your involvement and the local county's local county NAACP involvement in the Route 40 freedom rides and sit-ins during the early 1960s?
Well, my work at that particular time was basically in Howard County. So in the sit-ins, that would represent the groups in the Howard County branch. For a while, my wife was involved in visiting various restaurants along Route 40 to seek service. They were denied at all of those restaurants except for the one that that particular time was operated by the Chinese. That's in the city, back of Ellicott City there. So actually, area covered just from Route 40 back of Ellicott City up to about, was it Quince Orchard? I can't think of the little place up there. I went to Pine Orchard, Quince Orchard. Now, anyway, that's the only distance they covered. They didn't go on beyond that point up around Cooksville and all that way. I think on one occasion we did visit that little place there at Cooksville and talk with the manager. He said, yeah, he was willing to serve any and all who choose to come in. But I don't suppose there were too many except those who lived around Cooksville. We found that many of them were traditional bound and they didn't go there in the first place, except maybe to get alcoholic beverages or something. But as far as anything else, they were disdainful of the place. We found that out. Now, at that diner, Double T Diner, that Cadenceville, the Howard County group did not participate in any of those demonstrations, although they were led at that particular time by the brother of one of our dominant figures in the Howard County branch, James King. He's now president of the Howard County branch. And his mother had been a very effective worker of many years in the state of Maryland, around the vicinity of Lakeland and Beltsville, Prince George's County. Hester King was the namesake when I started in the civil rights work in Maryland. She was one of the namesakes out in the county as the king. Of course, she had three sons. Arthur King went on to the legislature. James King, very active in Howard County civic and social affairs and in the school system. And Eugene King in Baltimore County, okay, particularly around the Catonsville area. Beyond that point, is Howard County did nothing that one would say was sensational. We just did our homework well and pinpointed our strategic areas and then used more or less the bargaining approach with them. We didn't stage any massive demonstrations of that sort. Always generally got a group and went to the management, asked for a conference with them, sit down and talk with them, aired our views, generally initiated some change in behavior, or we conducted a mild form of a boycott. One of the two. That was the system that we used as a form of direct action. It was direct. We went to the management. Didn't find the day we found it. Or we left stronger demand that he get in touch with us. So we always tried in our approach to stay away from the veiled threats. I don't know how.